You're listening to the RV Fireside Chat Podcast with your hosts, Mark and Tricia Leach. Brought to you by E3 Camping, the ultimate destination for the RV community. Coming to you from somewhere different every day with the latest in RVing news, fun, and facts. Head over to e3camping.com to discover more. And now, here's your hosts, Mark and Tricia.
All right, welcome E3 Camping members to a very special webinar because we have Todd Henson with us, who is an E3 contributor in the RV maintenance and inspection realm. We're very excited to have Todd here with us today. Welcome, Todd.
Well, thank you so much, Mark, and you know, happy to be here.
Yeah, so Todd is the master instructor at National RV Training Academy out in Athens, Texas, and man, I'm so excited to tap into your knowledge and your expertise because you're out there providing certified RV technicians. But the thing I think is so exciting is you have RVers that go through your training just because they want to work on their RV and have that experience. Can you like maybe tell us a little bit more about your business and who you serve and that type of stuff? And then I have a list of topics that I want to talk about, like common RV repairs, like maybe essential and the best tools while traveling. I want to answer some questions about like a maintenance, annual maintenance list, some things like that, as maybe even de-winterizing and some seasonal stuff that might be coming up. We can talk about safety, how to select a good technician. I'm going to overwhelm you, Todd. All right. We got lots to do. And then also maybe even someone who's going to look for like looking to buy a used RV and they want to do like a self-inspection. We can talk about that. And then anything else you want to talk about? Cause I have a feeling the E3 Camping members, they don't care. They just want to know as much.
Absorb it all. Yeah,
absorb it all, right? So anyway, well, why don't we start a little bit with your business and who you serve?
Well, we've actually been in business a little over 7 years. My father-in-law, Terry Cooper, is the kind of the mastermind behind this. And he was actually teaching at the local state college. For college students that want to go into the RVing field and become certified technicians, and so he did that until he couldn't stand working with college students anymore, and was looking at kind of changing something. A lot of people started calling him because he started getting pretty popular who he is, and what had taken place was people would call him and say, "Look, we're about to purchase this coach over here, and the curtains are beautiful. But can you come look at it? Can you tell us if it's a good buy or not?"
Yeah.
And, that really started, the process. Well, why don't we train individuals to become certified RV inspectors? Because there's so many different services on these things. I mean, it's a house on wheels.
Yeah, sure.
And for a lot of us, we can look at the floor plan. We like the floor plan. Mm-hmm. We're told that it works really well, but we have no idea.
Yeah, but the axle's bent and the water heater doesn't work and there's rot on the floorboard. But the curtains, Todd, they look great.
That's right. That's right. The door closes,
Yeah.
Well, I'll say it does. Well, we started off from there and thought it would just be a kind of a boutique business, Texas and the surrounding states. Mm-hmm. And, not quite putting it together that RVers travel. Mm-hmm. So for 4 years, we would travel around to different RV parks and put on this training. And it was just for inspectors because there's a limited amount of tools that you need to do inspection work, right? It's just all diagnostic. Well, the longer that goes, the more we're getting popular and people are saying, what about technicians? Well, in order to do that, we had to have a facility. We have to have the hands-on items here. You have to have tools. So we had purchased the RV park about 3 years ago and built our facility here, what we call the Big Red Skull House.
Okay.
It's just 15,000 square foot building. We've got four bays, and I can have about, well, right now under COVID, we can have about 75 students in here at a time. So that's what we're doing now is we're training both for certified inspectors and for technicians, but probably about 50% of our class that come in, it's just individuals who want to learn how to work on their own RV. Not necessarily, they're financially fine, but they want to have a better RVing experience. And the way to have that better is to actually know, should something break down, is it something that you can repair?
Yeah, sure.
You take away that fear factor, you take away, that what if. And so, about 50% of the students come in, they start off coming in just thinking, I'm just here to learn on my own RV.
Okay. I've got two questions on that specifically. Maybe someone's listening and with the boom of the RV business right now, and I have to imagine that the dealers are being overwhelmed, that there is a big opportunity for maybe even mobile RV technicians. So is that a path that someone could go through your, and then go through your training, and then they could create their own mobile technician business?
Well, and honestly, that's pretty much probably about 80% of the technicians, you know, that we create are mobile technicians. Mm-hmm. We do have dealer techs that will send their technicians to us, but it's kind of a catch 22 for them, to be honest. You know, if they send them over to us for 1 week or 5 weeks, that technician's not producing any work for them. So,
gotcha. Okay.
You know, yeah. They want to send them to us. What they want to do is they want to hire, you know, they said, hey, you know, give us a list of all your students and we'll hire mm-hmm. them once they're done.
Gotcha.
But usually mm-hmm. if you're going to do this, and we're really the only school that caters to this, is to create mobile technicians. So we give them, you know, some business training as well mm-hmm. that we have here. So how to set up your, you know, your LLC, how to set up your license, get your insurance, you know, do a bunch of, you know, cover your assets, what I call cover your assets. Mm-hmm. That's just, you know, taking care of your liabilities.
Sure.
So there's probably about 80% of the students that we graduate that are technicians or mobile mm-hmm. technicians. Love the lifestyle.
I want to talk. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, what better way to have, you know, a technician work on your rig other than one that actually lives in a rig? You know, most of them at the dealership, I mean, they work 40 hours a week. They stay in a house. Most of them that we even train, they know very little about the RVs, to be honest.
No, I mean, I think that's a common thing. And I think people are kind of surprised to find out that a lot of salespeople actually came from an automotive lot. Maybe they, you know, have a friend that went from selling cars to saying, hey, I can sell RVs and it's easier and they make more money or something. And then they tell their friends, and next thing you know, a lot of times RV salespeople and at the dealer don't have the experience. And really, I've also found that the very best technicians in the RV dealer, with a few exceptions, of course, because there always are, they tend to go out and start their own business. So as you know, running a business is not easy. And I've always said, if you can run your own business, especially a mobile RV technician business, you're probably pretty good. And, you know, you've gone through the proper training. But I guess on that score, what are some things that people can ask a mobile technician to make sure that they, like maybe over the phone before they come out, before they're committed, to make sure they've got the right technician with the right training? And I'll just give you a quick example. I hired a mobile technician once, and we had some sealant work on Ginger 1.0, and he was going to use silicone on the outside of the RV. Now, that in our mind, right, because we've been doing this for a while, we know that you got to either use Sikaflex or you got to use what's that other stuff called? The it's like silicone, but it expands with the temperature.
Well, there's all different brands.
Geoflex. Is it Geoflex or something? Yeah. And then of course on the roof, you'd use Dicor, self-leveling or non-self-leveling. So when he was going to use the silicone, that was a red flag to me that, okay, so you might be a very experienced technician, but not on RVs.
Right.
So that's a red flag. What are some of the things that people need to ask a technician before they have them come out?
Well, and that's really the main thing, you know, is there should be communication before the technician comes out, right? Mm-hmm. If the technician's not asking you questions, then to me, they're just there, you know, you're just going to get a bill, right? Yeah. If they're willing to show up, you know, you just said my air conditioner doesn't work. Okay, I could be there in 30 minutes. I mean, it sounds great, you know, but they should be asking you questions. Okay, when you say it doesn't work, you know, and go through that, because if they're showing up, then they're what we call a part swapper. You know, you like, oh, your air conditioner's out, we just need to replace the whole thing. You know, for you, it's 100 degrees, you don't care, but now your bill's $1,200. And it could have been just through some questions. And you know,
so you're reminding me when we were in Estes Park, we had a leak on our propane hose. Uh-huh. And, you know, I knew exactly how to replace it. I knew exactly what the part number was. And I could have gone down to the store and got it done. But we were editing a video and we were going to go into the park. And it was a Friday. And I thought to myself, you know what? There was a guy in the park that had a, you know, RV mechanic, you know, magnet on his truck. And I thought, how much could this possibly be? I'm just going to have him come over and swap it out. I'm going to keep editing and we'll move on. And I don't have to worry about anything. Exactly what you said happened. So I call him up and say, can you come over? He says, oh yeah, I happen to be at the park right now. I'll be over there in 5 minutes. $125 fee to show up.
That's
his on-site fee was $125. The part, I'm getting excited now. Charlie's getting excited. So, and then the part was like, you know, marked up three or four times. And then I had, and then he rounded to about a half hour of labor. So it was like a $225 hose.
Oh my goodness.
So anyway, I think it's probably embarrassing I even share that story. But again, you know, I'm in my mind, I'm thinking, how much could this be? I'm going to stay focused on what I do. I'm going to have someone else do it. But what about training? Like, I imagine it's completely appropriate to ask what type of RV training or certification they've had. So how does that conversation go?
Yeah, you would have to ask them, you know, are they certified? And there's really only two certifying bodies. There's the, you know, the NRVTA has a certifying body. And then the RVIA, which is now no longer, you know, doing that. They actually created what's called the RVTI.
Okay.
They're still trying to get stuff set up. But yeah, you want to see what there are. Now, most of them, unfortunately, what we have is what I call, you know, the $2 in a truck. You know, guy's got a magnet, you know, has done some housework or something like that. And maybe wonderful, you know, wonderful contract or something in homes. And, you know, RVs are just enough different, you know, that you need some training on that.
They really are. There are some nuances, like we were saying, about the sealant and about products and about fasteners and mounting brackets. I mean, these things are made as light as possible, which means that often parts need to be replaced. And I know that frustrates a lot of people that things need to be replaced. But in a way, I think it's important to remind people that that's why they were designed to be replaced. They weren't designed to last. If they were designed to last, then manufacturers, and I'm not giving the manufacturers a pass, but from an engineering perspective, if something was designed to last, it would be heavy. And to be heavy, which means you would need a bigger tow vehicle, or you need a bigger engine, which means you'd have less fuel economy. Point being, there are consequences to weight that often the end user does not consider. And therefore they say, hey, I've had this thing for a year and it's broken. It's like, well, yeah, but if it was designed to last 3 years, you wouldn't have a vehicle big enough to tow it.
Exactly. Well, that, and we want more. Right. Yep. If you go back over to, you know, Indiana, and you go to, you know, their house there, and you get to see the older units, they're smaller, and they had, you know, residential type stuff in there.
That's true. But yeah, they had heavy. Things like they had these antique artifacts called screws, and they would go into the wood.
Right.
And now they've come out with this new modern technology called a staple. and sometimes they staple from underneath going up, and then the shelf can come down. But this is where I will give the manufacturers a hard time for doing things that are fast instead of efficient. But when it comes to actual how it's put together, I think it's important that you have a technician that knows what does it look like when you pull it apart, because they need to have the parts to put it back together.
Right. Exactly. That, and honestly, again, if you're just learning for yourself, I mean, you take away some of that anxiety. Most of the stuff we can repair ourselves if we just know a little bit more.
Right? Okay, so that's a good segue. So you say about half of the people that go through your training are RVers that want to just go through and learn how to repair on themselves. And they're in the same classes as the certified technician?
Right. Okay. Well, for the first class, what we call our fundamentals class. So everyone has to go through that.
Gotcha.
You know, we got to go over, you know, the basics of electricity, both AC and DC. We got to go over the fundamentals on propane, water systems, and then, of course, your major appliances. So everyone goes through that before they can go off to other classes. Now, if they're just going through their own, they'll just take the one class. Usually what happens is that, you know, about 50%. Sorry about that.
That's all right.
Usually what I said is about 50% of the students that come in start off, you know, just wanting to learn about their own RV. And by the end of the week, well, you know, probably about half of that, they'll decide to go ahead and take some more classes. They figure out that, you know, the information that they've gained is so much more than they really thought. They were like, well, why not? Let me
go to
the air conditioning class.
You know? I could see that. And I could also see, I'm just speculating from now, you know, living pretty much full-time in an RV for the last 5 years, that it's really not that complicated. I mean, you get into some of these motorized class A's and diesel pushers, that might be another story. I mean, you know, I've heard that it's like $5,000 just to drop the oil pan, and maybe that's an incentive for somebody to do it. But who are a lot of the typical RVers that come through? Are they mostly on the towable side or the motorized side?
Well, I'd say about 50-50. Most of them are, you know, come to our class, I will say, because they got to give a week up, they've got to pay for the class. But our park gets filled with both big Class A pushers and fifth wheels.
Okay.
You know, we have probably about 10% don't even own an RV yet. You know, they've watched your channel, they watched other channels, they're trying to figure out, you know what, I need to learn this stuff. They stumble upon us and they go, well, the best place to learn, let's come here, let's figure this out, because, you know, there's so many different opportunities, so many different things. You know, which floor plan do I go with? You know, because that's the question we always get, you know, brand new to RVing. Well, should I get a motorized or should I get a towable?
Yeah. Well, there's a lot, you know, there are definitely a lot of advantages, disadvantages to both, or pros and cons to both, but let's talk about some of these common repairs. What would you say are some of the more common repairs that RVers should or could make themselves?
Most of it, I would say, is going to be maintenance. Just as you were saying, we know that these things are designed to go out. They'll give you a year or two, usually at the day after the warranty goes out. Mm-hmm. But a lot of this is simply, you know, it's self-inflicted. You know, we don't do some of the maintenance ourselves.
Gotcha.
You know, so, you know, cleaning out your air filters on your air conditioner, that should be done monthly. You know, even, you know, if you look at it and say, well, I didn't have to do that much. That's great. But if we're moving them, you know, every time we move these, we end up in a different environment. You know, the air quality is different, everything else. And so we're used to most of the information we jump into an RV, we take along with us, you know, the same habits we've done in our house. So, you know, our house may be located in the area. Yeah. It's not very dusty. We don't look at those things very often. Now we start traveling, you know, and we use those same habits. Well, I'll check those once a year. And then you've got a cake full of dust up there. So, you know, a lot of this, like I said, it's almost self-inflicted. If we know how to look at these things and, you know, do some preventative maintenance, and these things will last a lot longer.
So maybe we can work together, if you don't mind, on creating a like an E3 camping inspection list, or maybe repurpose things that you already have, so that we can look at that. Because, like, for instance, sealant on the roof. You know, sealant on the roof is pretty interesting, because if you look very carefully, you can see like a little fingernail crack. And it might not look like anything, but that's letting water in. And it's letting water in so slowly that it's coming in, and it can create a delamination about 9 to 12 months later, right?
Right. Absolutely.
And it's something that you hardly even notice. I mean, it's easy to see a gaping hole and go, oh, I need to provide sealant. But it's another thing to actually know how to inspect the roof for sealant issues.
Well, and it's just to, you know, there's, how do I put, I don't know if you want to use this or not, but in the RV space, we actually use one of the lowest quality sealants there are. Dacor is one of the lowest quality, you know, sealants out there. It's because it's acrylic based, it's 40% water.
Okay.
So those cracks are from the sealant actually drying. So we just know twice a year, if you have Dacor up there, you need to get up there and inspect your roof, because that stuff actually shrinks.
Am I assuming that maybe you have a recommendation for a similar product that's self-leveling or non-self-leveling that's better than Dacor then?
There are, and it's limited out there. I not necessarily want to, because we actually hold, you know, one of the distribution rights on it. So I don't know if you want to do that, but, you want to look for something that doesn't dry out. That's why a lot of like contractors will go to a silicone. It's 99% solid. So it doesn't shrink. Problem is, it doesn't stick to anything, any type of rubber. So there's a new product, or, you know, what's being used on the Peterbilts, it's a polyurea. And so it's a 98% solid. So it acts just like a silicone, but it's an adhesive. It sticks to membranes. It sticks to PVC. It sticks to wood. Mm-hmm. So any type of substrate we can have on our roof, this will, you know, stick to it, but also work just like a silicone. It doesn't dry, it doesn't shrink, and it stretches.
I think there are probably a lot of people listening right now saying, yeah, where do I get this? That's what I'm thinking. So maybe we could just link to it or let us know.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, because I'm sure there'll be links and resources associated to this webinar, and then we can follow up with other stuff. But no, I mean, I'm 100% aware that the industry as a whole is counting every penny when it comes to the products they use. So I'm now not surprised to find out that the sealant is also potentially, you know, minimum, bare minimum.
Right.
So yeah. So stepping up from there. Okay. So I guess out of this, we'll come up with a list of like things to do, maintenance and things like that. I've always personally looked at lubricant and sealants, and checking the sealants and doing lubricants and things like Corrosion X when I wash the RV, because it kind of seems like the frequency of washing an RV for me, that might be about maybe every 3 months, would be the frequency to like look for sealant issues, lubricate steps so they proper, you know, so they function properly. Door locks, awnings. I use Corrosion X on the awnings so that the awnings stretch out pretty good. But that's an Airstream thing, I think. But they're going to get sealant, right? So, like, what about not sealants, but slides? What about slide maintenance?
Right. Really, the most common product you can get is a dry silicone. right? So we can use that on our slide outs. We can use that on our steps. We can use that on our leveling. Anytime it rains, you know, what's going to happen is that water is going to hit the ground. We're going to have dirty water jump up. It's going to hit, whether it be our landing gear or our steps.
Yeah, the stabilizers,
Yeah, stabilizers. We want to, you know, get a towel, wipe it down, and then put some dry silicone on there. And that will, and all of them, it doesn't matter, even with the slide outs, check with Lippert. They're totally fine with that as long as we don't overspray it. All we're trying to do is just put a thin layer of silicone on there. And it has to be a dry silicone because the propellant and all other, you know, types of aerosols is a butane and it's oily. And if it's oily, it can catch dirt. So we want to go with a dry silicone, which is just a, you know, it's an alcohol based propellant. So it instantly dries out and all it uses is that seal. So to me, every time I'm ready to pull out, I actually do a walk around and I'll go ahead and I'll wipe down my leveling gear and spray them down. If my steps are out, I'll go ahead and just give a quick spray. My slide outs out, I'll look up under there and go ahead and give them a quick spray and wipe those down as well.
Yeah. So do I, Todd. So do I. Every, hit the table. Every time, Todd, that's right. How I do it. Yeah. In the beginning of the year, in the beginning of the year, when we take off for 7 months. That's exactly what I do. Okay, let's talk about some of the essential tools. In fact, even within E3, I did a video on some of the essential tools I think someone like an RVer should have. And I think it depends a lot upon the RVer and how capable they are and what gives them their own personal comfort, how handy they are. But I'd love to hear from you what tools you think might be essential. And then also, you know, what tools might we need to have to make some of these repairs, like maybe some very common RV repairs that happen on the road.
Right. So, with that, you know, first thing I thought of, you know, you were saying that is, okay, what's emergency? Okay, well, if we have a flat, a lot of times what we see with RVers is they don't have the proper jacks. The best jack that you can get to actually get your rig up is a bottle jack.
Sure.
Okay, so bottle jacks, you know, they have a very small space that you can get them in because usually whenever we have a flat, you know, we've got very limited space. Now, if we have a fifth wheel or something like that, we want to do, you know, get some 2x6s and put them in a cross pattern, just cribbing, you know, because we want to elevate that bottle jack. But your regular standard jack that you would use on your truck really wouldn't work. You know, anything with wheels, you want to use a bottle jack, you know, get that up. Honestly, most of the stuff that we have, you know, is something that we can use screwdrivers, drill guns, and nut drivers. A lot of this stuff is just simple bolt on. So definitely want to, you want to bring your electric drill gun. You want to go ahead and have the, you know, proper bits. Most of this stuff is standard or SAE. So a quarter inch, eighth inch, 5/16ths. Definitely want all those. And then
another thing that comes to mind is all the Robertson bits, right? Because many towable RVs don't have, you know, any screw that they do have is actually a Robertson head, isn't it?
A number two square, right.
Yeah. Oh, is that what you said? Okay.
Yeah. No, I didn't, but thank you. You know, so on my list, I send out a tool list, you know, for everyone that comes to class, and I always tell them that, hey, look, get you a number two square head because you're going to be surprised. Most of the screws that are in there are a square head.
Okay. So, and then the other thing I'll say too, from experience and not a good experience, is that bottle jack. I agree. It's a great thing to have. And they only, I mean, they're about as big as this microphone, right? And which is great, but they also have like this microphone. They also have a very small point at the top. Yes. And I'm telling you, if someone's new to towable RVing and they do not know to chalk that trailer, and they are not connected to their vehicle, it could be life-threatening.
Disastrous.
Absolutely. Yeah, because, I mean, you got basically a point that's holding up 10,000 pounds, and if it rolls back, the way that – I mean, you'd have this situation with any jack, frankly, but a bottle jack, I think it's amplified because of the point of contact of the frame.
Right. You know, and it really depends on your space because, to me, I don't do any work under a jack. I will go ahead and get jack stands. The bottle jack is just to get it up, and then we put jack stands there for safety.
Yeah.
You know, and
so even, I mean, I think that's a great idea. And if you got a fifth wheel or a Class A, that's pretty easy to pull off. I suppose if you have a smaller RV, you know, having a couple jack stands in the back of your truck or in a bin is really not a bad idea, because they collapse down. They don't take up a lot of space. And if you do have to change a tire, you get that RV up, you put the jack stands, and now you know you've got an extra layer of protection of yourself.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's just, and it all depends on how much, you know, how much weight do you have available? Because as a toolie, you know, half of the cargo that we have are all my tools.
Yeah.
And I carry a ladder and everything else. And it's like, you know, this is not normal, but, you know, it's something that I do because they do break down.
Yeah. Well, you're also the master instructor over at a National Training Academy. So, all right. So let's talk about some of the common repairs. In almost every RV I've owned, I have had to replace the circuit board to the water heater.
Right.
And, you know, and I guess there was an issue for a long time with the Atwood water heater that it reached over about 140 degrees. It would break the circuit. So I moved everyone I've had this issue with. We moved over to a dyno board. And I bought it on Amazon for like $110, and it's just a single little socket, and I just throw it in and reconnect, and we're good to go. So I know personally, from my personal experience, that's a common repair. What are some things that you see that people might want to have like a spare of if they're going to go out on an extended trip and they don't want to have to go to a dealer?
Right. Well, a couple of things. One is, and I know it sounds, you know, how do I put this? It already sounds like you should already have these things, but you know, buzz fuses, you want to go ahead and have fuses. We, you know, resettle all fuses. Especially when it comes to landing gear, leveling gear, we want to have those resettable fuses. Most of this stuff, because it's 12 volt, we could just simply get at the auto parts store.
Yeah, sure.
Right. And so a lot of people, what they'll do is, you know, they'll try and find an RV store looking for something electrical. Well, they're going to mark it up. You're going to pay three times as much.
That's right.
If you go over to the auto parts store, they're going to have it. But definitely you want fuses because, again, if things are going out, if things are, you know, meant to actually break down, you want to go ahead and reset those. Having your tools would be good for there. Now, for me, and not that you should do this, but water pumps do tend to go out.
Yeah, I've replaced those.
You know, and it's just the design. And, I tell you, if we just put a check valve in front of that water pump, we won't have any problems. You know, but what it's just the design, the way they use these things. They use them as check valve. And that's why they go out.
I imagine it's not that difficult to add a check valve.
No, it's more difficult to get to your water pump in a lot of cases.
Sure it is. I mean, in most of the RVs I've had, you've got to pull down some sidewall, or it's in the storage compartment, and you got to lay on your back and upside down, and you're putting something on it, make sure it's getting 12 volt power. And you know, if it's not, that's easy, right? You change the fuse or something, and if it is, then you got to change the pump out.
Right. And, you know, RVs, both electrical and water, and not saying that everyone can do electrical, but because we can just, it's so simple for us to unhook from electrical power, we can go ahead and make these updates. So, you know, some people, they'll say, oh, well, I don't want to mess with even 12 volt. Well, you know, putting in a check valve, that's just simply putting an inline check valve, you know, in the cold water line. So that way we're not putting pressure on the pump. Gotcha. But yeah, it's like I said, the hardest part, you know, is getting to it. Most of this stuff, when we break it down and look at the individual parts, super simple. It's where is it? Where is it located? And how do I get there?
Yeah. Yeah. And then I've said this before on the channel, and I think you've even mentioned this within the E3 course curriculum. And that is that, you know, a lot of times, like when we went to Alaska, we carried an extra leaf spring and U-bolts and bearings. You know, the idea was that we were thinking if we were out in the middle of Yukon somewhere and we were about 800 miles from the nearest something, that we didn't want to have to find the part. Right. And, you know, sometimes I get a lot of criticism that, you know, suggesting to have some of these big parts or carry these big tools is overkill. But I will say, as an RVer, I know firsthand that if you have a problem, you're going to have four or five other RVers who have a lot of experience that are willing to help, especially the type of RVer that's going to pull over and help you on the side of the road is probably somebody like you. You know, it's probably not an RVer that goes, oh, I don't know how to fix it. But the person that's going to pull over is probably going to have a jack, electric tools. I mean, they might have power tools. And so our philosophy, and I suppose we maybe adopted this when we went down to Mexico for 3 months, is we wanted to carry the parts that we knew were going to be hard to find for RV. And even if I didn't know how to swap them out, I knew somebody did. I just wanted to have it. You know, in Mexico, I mean, you could be 3 weeks before you get the right part. I mean, I knew guys down there with a Class A, took them 3 weeks to get the serpentine belt. You know, right. You're talking 5 minutes to throw that thing on, but 3 weeks to get it. And so, so that I know that particular RVer, I think his name was Alan. Actually, he said, "Well, I'm never going to travel without this again. I mean, why would I want to travel without the parts that I know are so hard to get?" And I think, you know, Mexico is the extreme example, but I think even out in the middle of Montana, it'd be kind of nice to just have some basic parts that might be hard to get. And they're not even that expensive. The leaf spring, a bearing, belts, and certain parts like this. Maybe it is a little extreme, but I don't know. I like being independent.
I think usually what you tend to see is whatever specific event happened to you, you ended up getting two, and that's what you carry. Someone else, it may be an extra tongue jack. Well, you know, it's $100. You know, they had problems with theirs. They will. They'll just simply go ahead and have another one just in case.
You know, for the longest time, we carried two spares and we called it the two spare club. And the thinking here about this was that when we had a spare, I did not want our entire mission of the trip to now be finding a tire shop to get this replaced, because if we had a second spare, we would have to get towed. Right. And I think for those that are going out for a 3-day weekend, that might still be a good philosophy, because if you get a flat and you're on a 3-day trip and you get a flat on day one, your trip could be pretty much over, or you're taking the chance that you're going to just say, "Hey, I hope I don't get another spare in the next 2 days." So I was always a big advocate of the second spare. And if you have a towable RV, that BAL hide a spare that bolts onto the frame is brilliant. I mean, it's totally hidden completely underneath the RV. In fact, it's so easy to get access to that spare that became the tire I went to first, rather than getting the crank to bring down the tire.
And I recall that. I remember watching your video on that. And so, you know, we looked at it when we got our fifth wheel. I was, you know, same thing. I was like, "Well, I have six tires. We definitely need to carry two."
Yeah. Well, and you know, the thing is, what's interesting is those G-rated tires, even the Chinese Westlake that Momentum puts on, or a lot of the manufacturers, those G-rated tires really have not had that many problems. We didn't have any problems. And then when I went to the Goodyear Endurance, you know, we haven't had any problems, knock on wood. But, you know, that doesn't mean that you're not going to still hit a screw. It doesn't mean you're not going to hit a pothole and get an impact. What do they call it? Like an impact break or something like that. And it, you know, it damages the inside of the tire. And then about 500 miles later, bam. So, I mean, you know, even if you swapped out your tires with so-called good tires, you could still end up having a flat, and being prepared just makes things a little bit smoother.
Definitely. Now for us, we actually had tire separation. This is why, you know, for me, I like TPMS systems, but I hate them because they make us lazy. You know, again, each time we should go out, we should look at the condition of our tires, not just rely on the pressure and the temperature, but get out and walk. So for me,
every time you are so right. I mean, you're right. Yeah. I mean, I sit in my cab of my truck and I've got all the temperatures and all the thing, and I stopped inspecting them, right? Which is not good. Right. You know, before you get off, you should go into there and take a look. And so, I mean, you know, we went to Alaska and we had that bent axle. So, you know, Alaska was a 12,000 mile trip. We get home and the wire is showing on the inside of the tire. That's because I wasn't inspecting them, because I had a TPMS system and I didn't have to, right? So that really represents the importance of making sure that, you know, at some frequency, I'm putting my hand on the back and I'm checking the, you know.
Right.
Because that could be bad, right?
For me, I still carry a little thermal gun. Every time I get out for fuel, I'll go ahead and hit those axles, you know, hit the bearings to make sure that, you know, they're not getting too hot.
Yeah.
And on that, you know, it's just, if I've got three axles, you know, if I hit one and it say it's 110, if I hit the next one, it should be roughly around 110, maybe
within about 5 degrees. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. Actually, about 20, you know, 20 or 30 is fine. But if I'm hitting 200, I've got a problem. There's, you know, there's not enough grease in there. So, you know, and just having that gun, you just walk around and hit each one of your axles, you know, walking around while you're fueling. It doesn't take
nothing
extra
else to
time.
Do. And on some of these big tanks, it takes, if you're not at a truck stop, fueling can take a long time. So yeah, I like having something to do like that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that's, I mean, like I said, I like TPMS systems. I actually keep it up because it's just like anything else. You're looking at it, but when the tire goes, it's going to go.
Yeah.
The TPMS doesn't warn you, "Hey, you know, you've got bad tread, or you've got uneven wear, or you've got, you know, tire separation." It's checking pressure.
So while we're on the topic of safety, of tire safety, but let's talk a little bit about, I get this question a lot of people write in asking if they should leave their propane on to keep their fridge cold while they're towing. And the problem with this question is if you go to Facebook and ask, there's 100 comments, over 90 of them are absolutely been doing it for, you know, 10 years. And by popular vote, propane stays on, but there are some inherent risks, and I know where you stand on this. So what are your thoughts?
And I think I'm the lonely voice out there. I'll put it this way. It is because it is legal. In other words, we don't have any rules against driving with propane on, except for going into tunnels or pulling into gas stations.
Yeah.
So the question is for those of you that travel with your propane on, when you go fuel up, do you stop before you get to your fuel station and turn off your propane every single time? Probably not. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, if we have a propane on, that means we have a flame somewhere, right?
Somewhere.
We usually say, let's say it's our air conditioner, I mean our refrigerator. We want to make sure that our food is cold enough we're going down the road. People will say that these are designed, propane appliances we have are designed to actually be on while they're going down the road. No, they're not. They're modified, and we keep modifying them. But the problem we have, and not to get, too geeky on this, but as we're traveling down the road, we have high-pressure winds, going across each one of these appliances, and we've got a fire inside. Well, if I've got this high-pressure wind, what happens is it forces all the air out, which means it forces that flame out. Mm-hmm. And this is where we get, potential fire hazards that we have with people traveling down the road with their propane on. Now, what happens is Dometic, Norcold, Suburban, they keep doing recalls. They're trying to find a way to block that high pressure versus low pressure situation that we have and try and prevent that fire from coming out. You were talking about that circuit board on the Atwood burning out. Let's see here. So happen to have one right.
You just happen to have that. You just happen to have that right there. One. I keep mine right here, Todd. But I'm going to leave it there because you have yours.
You were talking about just carrying extra stuff with you. So. Yeah. But right here we've got a thermal fuse right in front of right here where our burner assembly is.
Yep.
And that is there on the outside simply because. What they're trying to do is make sure if you're going down the road, fire comes out, that would hopefully melt this and basically send a signal back over and says, hey, cut the propane. We've got fire coming out here. I mean, again,
that's what that's for. Okay.
It wasn't designed that way. They're just trying to modify it because of our habits.
Okay. Interesting.
So to make this shorter, if you can find another way, not to drive with your propane on, I would suggest doing that.
Well, if you have, we've got a battery bank and we can move our fridge over to automatic, but it takes about, I think it takes about 125 watts, which is quite a bit to run that propane fridge. Propane fridges are inherently very inefficient. So now Dometic has just come out with, they have that CFX mobile cooler, which is just about the coolest thing ever. I mean, they really are 100% solid. And so now what Dometic has done recently is they've taken the guts of that CFX motor and they've put it inside the form factor of a Dometic fridge. Mm-hmm. And what's cool about that is you swap it out to that. Now it's running, I think it runs about 4 amps, which I think converts out to what it was about like 35 watts.
4 times 125. You're still about 325 unless you're talking 12 volt.
Well, it's 12 volt. It's about 300 watts, 12 volt, I think. I was talking to the Dometic guy out in Elkhart about it. I'm doing this from memory, but it's significantly less than.
That'd be about 48 watts, because that'd be 12 times 4. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So in that case, swapping it out. Now the other advantage of doing that is if you've got that ventilation system on the outside of your RV specifically for the propane fridge. Well, now that becomes storage because you don't need that spot anymore, and so. So that's an upgrade we were looking at. Now, if you don't want to upgrade your fridge to a residential fridge, or you don't want to install a big battery bank, or you don't want to go in and change the fridge out, another alternative is to turn it off and put in the block freezer things, just transfer it down from the freezer into your fridge. Yep. And we have found about a 1 degree temperature drop per hour of driving.
Right.
At least in our fridge, in our RV at that time.
Right.
I think the biggest, go ahead.
Oh, sorry.
I was just going to say the biggest drawback we have found by turning off the fridge while towing with the propane off is not remembering to turn it back on. And so I think there needs to be, if you, there just needs to be a very good way to remind you that when you get to wherever you're arrived, that you can turn it back on. Like there's some big flashing thing that says turn the fridge back on. Cause at 8 o'clock at night, if you arrive at four, it's 8 o'clock at night, your food's gone.
Right. So for us, I leave it on electric, you know, okay. Because you'll have the, either the auto or the propane or electric and propane. If you leave it on electric, what'll take place is it'll beep. It'll just continue to beep at you.
That's a good point. Yeah. That's a great point.
There's no AC. So as soon as I plug back in, it just turns back on. I've never put mine on propane. But I do the same thing. My motto is that a refrigerator just simply turns to an ice box. It's how many hours can you go, mm-hmm. you know, before that temperature. So I do one more step is, and I look at, you know, the current situation, my refrigerator. If it's my drinks, my vegetables, my fruit, I can care less if that gets 45.
Sure.
So then I just take all, you know, my meats or whatever, and I stick those in the freezer. If yep. I have room.
Sure.
Because now the freezer's no longer freezing. Yep. Now it, you know, now we've done our test and we've got about 6 hours and our freezer was still below 32 degrees.
I could see that. Yeah. So, I could see that. Yeah, and I'll throw out one more tip. There is a device that we have. I'm trying to think of the name, but it'll be in the resources associated to this webinar, but there are these little cubes and they're about $45 and it's a temperature sensor. And uh-huh. It's called sensor push is what it's called. And I actually have the app on my phone. But what is interesting about this is it's Bluetooth to my phone, but it remembers the temperature at all times. So we keep one in the fridge. I can go into the app and I can look at the 24-hour history of the temperature. This because Trish is really big on not cooking with food that has maybe been spoiled. So the problem is, and rightfully so, I think you only have to get food poisoning once. So what ends up happening is let's say you're sleeping or something happens and your fridge goes up to 60 degrees and it stays there to spoil your food. And then you wake up or you get to where you're going and it's back down to 30, 40, you never know the difference. So with this app, I can go in and I can look at the history of the fridge. And then I can also set up alerts. So it actually sends a push notification to my phone saying, hey, this fridge is up over 55 degrees.
I have yet to come across this. That's pretty neat.
It's cool. And I tell you what, for $89, I bought a router that I connected to my Jetpack, Verizon Jetpack. So it actually uh-huh. sends us push notifications of the temperature inside the RV when we're out hiking for Charlie. And, you know, unlike Pet Safety and other brands, this is, you know, there's no subscription for this.
Right.
And it's cheap, you know, like $89 that. For the router and $45 for each cube. So I got a cube in the on the outside of the RV for, you know, outside temp. I got a cube inside the RV and I got a cube in the fridge. And then I hook up all those little sensors to my phone and it works great.
All right. So I will wait for this link. Cause
okay. Well, it'll be in the resources of this. But I love having it. I like looking at my phone and seeing the history of everything. Not just the temperature, but the history.
Right. See, I have one that does the same thing. It's Bluetooth, but the actual display is magnetized. You put it up on the refrigerator,
okay,
and sure. it'll actually show the highs and the lows. And it shows, but you don't know when it hit that temperature. You don't know if that's one you haven't reset. So this would be pretty neat. You know, I'm even thinking about those that, you know, maybe have, you know, want to put one down in their storage bay next to their water.
Well, yeah, sure. Yeah.
And they're in cold temperatures. Hey, what's the temperature down there in my storage bay?
Yeah. All right. So we got two more based on the time of the year. I think maybe any tips that you have for dewinterizing, and then I want to talk about self-inspections too, but here pretty soon, at least from when this is recorded, people are going to be pulling their RVs out. And so maybe when they flush the toilet, the pink lemonade's going in there, or maybe they blew it out with a hose and they have to get it. So what tips do you have for getting the rig ready to hit the road again in the spring?
I think in all cases, if you have it winterized, whether you're putting in the pink stuff or you have it blown out, this is a perfect opportunity to go ahead and sanitize your lines. You know, they have been sitting there for a couple weeks, you know, especially if you blow them out. I'm not a fan of blowing out your lines because you are introducing new bacteria in these lines.
Okay.
And so for me, if you do choose that, because it is a little bit easier, you know, for those people that say have an air compressor, you know, you've taken that compressed air that's inside that little air compressor. It's not clean.
No.
You know, you send it through those lines and, you know, you still have moisture in there. You've just given that, you know, bacteria a couple months to grow.
Yeah, you've just really prevented water from expanding to crack the line. But yeah, that's a good point. Okay.
So what that is to do with sanitization, it's already there. So now you just want to introduce, you know, whether it be a product that you get to go ahead and sanitize it, or, you know, getting kind of a industrial grade, hydrogen peroxide, you know, 20% hydrogen peroxide. That's perfect. You know, go ahead and put that mixture in our water tanks, holding tanks, and run those through the lines, let that sit a day, and then going ahead and do our flush out. But I will say, when it comes to dewinterizing, it's this little contraption right here that tends to fool people. Now, this is primarily on the back of a water heater. What I'm going to do, I'm going to turn the camera over real quick over here to what I have, the backside of a water heater.
Yeah.
And all water heaters, basically, all the water comes in from the cold side. That's where the pressure comes in, comes up the hot side. When it's time for us to winterize, what we'll do is we'll do what's called a bypass. We'll bypass this right here. What happens is the water hits this check valve, can't go anywhere, so it goes up. Oh, this bypass valve is open, so I can go through. It can't come through here. And then that's how we actually set up a bypass on our water heater.
The problem is this stock OEM? Like, is this really all manufacturers, or have you created this new
product? No, this is stock. Unless you have a water bay where you can actually go ahead and turn it to winterize, you know, that's the only thing. If you don't have, you know, something like this, a water bay, this is what's on the backside of your water heater, right? Okay. Mm-hmm. The problem that we have is that, you know, the way these check valves work is if they're perpendicular to the lines, they've cut them off. But if they're parallel, they allow it. So what takes place is, and the tip that I want to get to is when we're dewinterizing, we're ready. We want to go ahead and put water back in our water heater. What we'll do is we'll turn this one open. We'll let the flow go back out, but we'll forget to turn this one off. And 9 times out of 10, I'll have someone reach out to me in the different groups and says, I don't think my water heater's working because when I turn on my water, I get warm water. Mm. The problem is they forgot to shut this bypass valve off.
Gotcha.
Remember, all pressure comes from the cold water side, and water's just going to find its equal. It's going to find the easiest path to go through. So it says, oh, I can go in here and try and push this water up, or I can just go right through here. And so, you know, what we need to do is when we're dewinterizing, we want to make sure that we cut that one off, make the water go in to the bottom of the tank, come out the top.
Gotcha.
And this right here, this little bypass valve, that really, you'd be surprised at how many people, you know, tend to forget to do that.
Okay, good tip. Really good tip. So now let's talk about, I got a follow-up question, this hydrogen peroxide. So my desanitization method was about a cup of Clorox or bleach, Clorox, I guess Clorox, for, I don't know, I think about like 40 gallons of water. And then, you know, we would put that in the fresh water tank, and then we'd fill it up to about 80%, and we'd drive down the road, it would slosh all around, and then we would run that through the lines by opening up all the, you know, sinks and everything, and let that run through, and then drain it, fill it, drain it. Hydrogen peroxide, this is a new one to me. Are you saying in lieu of Clorox or in addition to?
So they kill different things. The problem that we have, the reason the hydrogen peroxide is it's not as caustic and it doesn't eat the lines. The problem that we have with bleach is anything that's rubber, any one of our washers or anything else, if it's in there, if it's too high of a concentrate, it'll begin to eat that rubber. And that's why we can't.
And I would say that people are probably a little bit more liberal in their, isn't more better when it comes to killing stuff, right? So, I mean, if you're like a cup, you'd be like, oh, it doesn't seem like enough. You could add another cup.
I see it online. It says, well, because you look at it and to do it, and what it is, it's a quarter cup to every 15 gallons.
Okay.
All right. Very good. That puts you under 800 parts per million. Under 200 parts per million. Okay. And that's where we want to be. The problem is, you know, we want it to sit for 8 hours. Well, people, they'll look at this and go, well, I don't have time for that. And I see suggestions online that people will say, well, if you do a cup for 50 gallons for 8 hours, we'll do 2 cups. You don't have to let it sit there for 4 hours.
Yeah, no, you can't have a baby in 4 months with 2 women or something, some analogy like that, right?
Exactly. So just with that is just, make sure that you follow those guidelines. Stay under that 200 parts per million, you know. Quarter cup to every 15 gallons.
Okay. Cup to every 15 gallons. Let it sit in there for 8 hours. Do you also suggest driving around though, so it sloshes around, or do you just fill it up to about 90% and let it sit?
Fill it up to 100%. Right. Okay. Because we want to get all the way up to the top before we're for.
Well, center. I guess I always try to do it before a drive day so that it would oscillate.
Yes. And you could, yes. If it's one of those where you don't have those 8 hours, you know, if you don't do it like the day before you leave, mm-hmm. you know, then you could do it overnight, but sometimes you tend to forget, you wake up and you get you a cup of water.
Yeah.
75-80%, let it slosh around. Absolutely. You could do that.
Okay, but that's a good point about hydrogen peroxide. So you're saying hydrogen peroxide instead of Clorox, but you're right. I mean, hydrogen peroxide is really not as caustic at all.
Right. Right. And so, I mean, it's not the same stuff that you would get, you know, say at your local grocery store. You do want to get the industrial strength of 20 or 30%.
Where do you find this?
It does cost a little bit more, but I mean, that's the same thing without, you know, having the potential caustic problems.
Okay. So what's the parts per million, so to speak? How much per 15 gallons of hydrogen?
If we're going to do that, we want to try and keep it around that level. So yeah, if you have that 30%, you would want to probably put in 2 gallons of the 30%, you know, to your tank.
I don't understand that. 30 gallons of 2 gallons, 30%. I mean, well, I guess I'm looking for cups per.
Right.
Doesn't work that way.
Right. So for your hydrogen peroxide, I guess the downside to that is you have to use more hydrogen peroxide than you would the Clorox. So with that, we want to try and keep it around 20 or 30% for the whole tank.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. So okay, it is one of those you'd have to put in several gallons in order for that to take place. It doesn't have to be 30%. We just want to keep it above the 5%, the 3% that you would get, at your local store.
Okay.
This one, the higher the strength, the less time we'd have to let it in there, but or keep it in there. And so,
but it's not damaging the seals and some of the rubber components, and it's not as caustic to have residue left in there afterwards after you flush it out, right?
Exactly. No, doesn't leave a smell, anything else. You let it, same thing. You flush it, set it right back up. There's a cost factor. It does cost more than just a stiff cup. Bleach, but like I said, it's some people are kind of adverse to bleach.
Yeah, I don't blame them. Okay, cool. So other dewinterizing stuff. So we talked about actually dewinterizing it. You talked about sanitizing, which is awesome. I would imagine obviously tire pressure and things of this nature. What else comes to mind in terms of preparation to hit the road again?
Last thing I would think is condition of the batteries. If we have not upgraded to lithium, we have lead acid batteries. We have to service those.
Yeah.
So the more we use those, the more we have to put in distilled water.
Sure.
So on that, I would say once a month, pop the caps on those 12-volt batteries and check the level of water in there. We don't want to fill it all the way to the top, mm-hmm. but just at the bottom of the cap.
Okay.
And we have to use
distilled water. So when a battery expert told me that you need to add distilled water for every 1 week, the batteries are off-grid, meaning not connected to shore power. Or not mm-hmm. being charged by a trickle charger. That really put it in perspective to me as to why I kill lead acid batteries so fast, right? Because I'm not checking the water levels for every 1 week I'm off, right? Because if you're out on a 1 month trip, you could be off grid for many days, maybe 2 days here and 3 days here and 2 days here. I might not check the water level on that entire time.
Most people don't. They just wait till it doesn't charge anymore.
And that's the problem, right? Yeah.
Right.
And then,
right.
And so, but the combination of not adding the water and maybe them dying once or twice, I think that's why they take a hit. Now, AMG, of course, is better because you don't have to add the water and they still need to be ventilated, but, or do they? AMG?
Well, they say they don't have to, but if you were to hook up an inverter, it's the charge and discharge. The more demand that we have from those, yes, we can get some off-gassing in there.
That's what I've heard. That's why I paused, yeah.
When it gets a little too hot. Now, they don't do it normally. What they do is they keep it sealed, and so whatever water does dissipate, it hits the top of the cap, reconstitutes, goes back down.
Gotcha.
But, yeah, if it gets too hot, they do have these little emergency little caps that pop out. So we just want to make sure that we don't want those in our living space.
Yeah.
Should we be using the AGMs?
AGMs, yeah, that's what they are, not AMGs. I must have been thinking about the Mercedes, the new Mercedes Class B AMG. Right. All right. And then, of course, lithium, of course, the advantage there is that you really don't have to do much and you don't really have to think about them and you don't really have to worry if they die and you don't have to worry about where you keep them and you don't have to add any water. So, I mean, they're pricey, but there are peace of mind.
They're getting better. They're getting better on pricing. The only thing you have to worry about with lithium is getting them too cold.
Yeah.
You know, charging them and discharging them when it's 30 degrees outside.
I you know what though? I mean, Battleborne Batteries just came out with a huge study and they tested it side by side, and it turns out they actually perform even better than lead acid, even though they have that reputation. So it's like lead acid has the same, they're susceptible to the same issues, but it's just not a known, like in their PR, where it's like lithium is like, oh, that's the drawback, but really it's they perform the same.
The difference though is if you go lithium and you spend that, usually you go ahead and get an inverter, so you're using 10 times the energy. Most of us that, you know, for people who just have their batteries, they're just running 12 volts, and so there's not a big demand on those batteries. So yes, they work or better in cold temperatures.
Usually, but you're right, though, you're asking more out of them. And of course, in most cases, you know, your lithium is in a secure place, and in our case it's up in the front of the RV, and it tends to be warmer there. But if we were in super cold temperatures, it would be very easy to open up a compartment inside the rig to let in some heat inside there.
Yeah, it's a simple fix. It's just one of those people forget, you know, and that's all it is. Or they're not aware of it yet. You know, lithium we're still, what, about 10% of the RV population may have switched over.
Yeah, that's true.
It's still emerging.
Yeah. All right. That's a great point. All right. Well, now let's just wrap up with self-inspections. I think, too, this is going to become even more popular as the pandemic has created such a demand and so many people have to stay in the United States and they decide, hey, I'm going to go buy an RV. But I have a feeling 2021, maybe 2022 is where you're going to see a lot of people say, hey, that was fun. I did it. I went on a trip. I hit all the national parks. Time to sell an RV. And I think there actually might be a good opportunity for people to in the used market. Right. But that also means that you're buying an RV from someone that wanted to dabble in RVing for a year. And they might have made many of the mistakes that we've talked about so far. So what are some of the, you know, let's say top 3 to 5 things that someone needs to look at when they do a self-inspection?
I think the biggest tip I can suggest is test everything. If they do not have it hooked up to water, I wouldn't take it. Gotcha. You know, cause you want to test it, you know, same thing, electricity, you know, cause they could say everything works. And most of the time that, you know, even with brand new ones, and we see this, and you know, we just pulled in a Van Lee, same thing. We had water issues and it was with some of our friends, they're inspectors, but the dealership did not have it hooked up to water. They said, we could still fix it. And sure enough, they pulled it in. We had to jump out there. We had 3 water leaks. You know, so to me, it's test everything. Even if you don't, you know, if you're not crawling in there, you want to test all your water. And the thing about water pumps is you know, they're on demand. So if you put some water in the water tank and put it on the water pump, if the water pump runs for a couple seconds, shuts off, and then for no reason, a couple seconds later, it comes back on, you've got a small leak somewhere. And it's an easy way to test that.
Wait, let me stop you there, because I think for a lot of people that aren't familiar with the sounds of an RV, I want to make sure they know what to sound for or listen for. Like a lot of people, when they get a new RV, they're like, oh, how come my sensors don't work? It's like, because the sensors aren't supposed to be there anyway. That's why. Right? Like, because it doesn't matter. Other than your freshwater sensor, you're just going to know, because you're going to know how things sound.
Right.
So the water pump makes a, you know, like a vibrating humming sound. When it pumps, right? In fact, if you're going to take a shower on a water pump, it would sound like brr, 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 go over and over and over again as it's pumping water. Right. So you're saying you're in this case, you're going to test the water pump. You would not be connected to water, but you would have water in your fresh water. You turn the water pump on, you turn the kitchen sink on, and it runs. Uh-huh. And then you turn it off.
And then
you're saying if it comes on again, you've got a leak somewhere?
Yes.
Because I hear that, Todd, in our rig. I hear that.
The way a water pump works is it's an on-demand pump. What it does is whenever it pumps through those lines, it actually will stop between 40 and 50 pounds of pressure. Mm-hmm. And so as soon as we turn on the faucet or something like that, that pressure drops and the water pump says, oh, it's time to come back on. Well, if you got a slow leak, you know, you've got no demand anywhere. You check around, you don't have any drips coming from your faucet. But from time to time, your water pump,
we've done podcasts, Todd, and we've had to stop in the middle of the podcast because the water pump would come on and we would go, what was that? And then I'd say, oh, it's just the water pump. I'd say, oh, it's just the water pump. And now really what I should have said is, oh, we just have a leak in our RV.
Right. Right. So, you know, then, you know, from there you'd have to track it down, but that's a simple way, you know, for, you know, the, the RV purchaser, you know, the RV buyer to go ahead and test the system, is all they got to do is listen, right?
Okay. Yeah.
Same thing. If we're doing anything propane, you want to test all your items on propane. And if anything sounds like a jet engine, it's all about listening. You go out, you want to, you know, turn on your furnace right now. How do you turn on your furnace in the summer?
Yeah.
Well, all you have to do is run the air conditioning for a while and let it get pretty cool. Let the air conditioning, you know, if you're going to do a self-inspection, plan on a couple hours. Right.
Yeah. Which means that you got to have a buyer that knows what you're going there to go do. And I would also say, out of respect for the buyer, this should be something that is done when you are ready to write a check. I mean, to go take 2 hours of someone's time or ask them to move an RV to an RV park to hook up or something so that you can just go check it out. Isn't the best use of anybody's time. But if you look at the RV, you understand the layout's good, the floor plan's good, and you've negotiated a price, I would say the price would be contingent upon a 2 hour inspection, and they're going to do it themselves, and we're just going to meet at an RV park. And if it all checks out, you're probably going to stay in the RV that night and sign over the title and move on.
Absolutely. I mean, and it's one of the last steps before you take it.
Okay.
You know, it's not something that you would do just by looking at this. It's, yes, you've already got the price. You've already done that. You're saying, hey, last step, before I take it from you, I want to test everything.
So we got propane, we got the water, we got the propane, we got the AC, we got the heat. I say propane, but I mean like the hot water heater and things like that. I would imagine a lot of new RVers or first-time owners really don't even know what all these systems are. So I think we're going to have another checklist here so that they can take their checklist and know, like, for instance, does the RV have an electric side to the water heater and a propane side? How do we check both? Right. Things of this nature, which, of course, that's kind of hard because the electric side of the water heater takes a longer time to test, to heat up and really test, whereas the propane, I think, is pretty quick, right?
It's the same.
Is it the same?
Yeah, it's the same.
So in my mind, it takes longer because there's not a flame.
Yeah, basically they've got it all figured out. The BTU rings, how much electricity needs to work to do the same amount that, you know, the propane.
I heard that they heat the water differently. That the electric side of it heats it inside of a tube, whereas the propane heats it from the flame.
Just so happen to have one.
I know. I should really bring mine from over here.
So you see the tube that's in here, right?
Yeah.
What we call the flue tube. Yeah. And so basically that big tube is actually what is heated from the propane, you know, from here.
So the water's in there and that big tube is going in there and it's just boiling it.
Water just boils around it. Yeah. Now, if you have a heating element, it will be on the back and it's in there, but it's dark.
Gotcha. Okay. That's the electric version.
So, yeah, and that's just the electric version. Now, the heating element is hotter, but it has less space.
Okay.
Whereas the flue tube, you know, the burner tube in there.
It's like a boiler.
Space. So now the great thing is if you have both, if you want really, if you want hot water fast, you can turn both on.
Well, that's just what I was going to ask you. And I think you're going to have a higher, what's the word, retention, water retention. Meaning that if you have a 17 minutes, if it's 17 minute retention,
right,
but you have both the electric and the propane on, you might reduce that to 12 minutes.
Right. And you can take longer showers, you know?
Yeah. You take longer showers. That's exactly right.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. So getting back to the self-inspection, we got the water, the propane, the AC, the furnace, the water heater. I would think though for towable RVs, the issues to look at would be the suspension, the leaf springs, the axles, the leaf spring hangers, the tires, things of this nature. What about the motorized side? What types of things, or do you think on a motorized side, it really maybe should be taken to a mechanic to look through everything?
Right. Definitely. You know, it's like self-diagnosing your own blood work.
Yeah.
You know, so with that, the biggest thing for all of these is you're going to be looking for water intrusion. Mm. I mean, you want to take your time. You want to look at all your walls, the corners, you know, you're looking for soft spots on the floor and on the wall. You don't have to have any tools because obviously the seller doesn't want you poking around with a screwdriver, but man, you'd be surprised at what you can feel with your hands.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're touching all the walls up in the corners and look for stains, open up cabinets, look in the back because it's all about, I mean, our biggest enemy is water.
Sure.
And that happens quite a bit. And, you know, for a lot of these, I don't put this, but you know, as the buyer, you always wonder, are they selling a headache or are they just selling it because they're getting out of the lifestyle? And if it's a headache, you want to catch that.
Yeah. Okay.
So,
Yeah.
Definitely want to look for water intrusion signs, you know, stains, signs of water damage, especially in the corners, because majority of the time it comes from our roof, sometimes from our windows, but majority of the time up on our roof. And so we want to always look up in the top, like behind me, you know, and look in the ceiling areas.
Yeah, this checklist might need to include some pictures of what something should look like, because for a new RVer, when you start talking about touching things that are soft, well, there's a lot of areas in an RV that are soft anyway, like the walls. Right. So it could be misleading. Yeah, I mean, you touch something, you're like, oh, it's like, well, that's not water intrusion. That's how they build them. So, you know, but I mean, what does delamination look like, and how to look for things like that? Sure. And then the other thing is, you know, when I did a Mooride suspension upgrade on our Grand Design Reflection, everyone thought that Cliffs Welding bent the axle, because the way in the image, the jack was directly under the axle. And right. All it was doing is holding the axle up. It was like, it was holding it up. It wasn't lifting the RV. The RV was on jack stands.
Right.
So if it wasn't the jack holding it up in the middle, it would have been Jake holding them up in the middle.
Right.
And they said, dude, Cliffs bent your axle, because axles have a crown. And if you don't know that axles have a crown, they'll all look bent to you. And so that's another thing. If you go in there, you'd be like, oh, these axles are bent. In fact, if it's straight, it's probably bent.
Right. Well, if it's straight, well, and these are specifically torsion axles.
That's true.
So you have in your Airstream, anytime where, you know, you don't have leaf springs, but you got an independent suspension, you're going to have that, you're going to have a frown.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, I've taken, you know, it was actually, we took our Airstream frame to have it rebuilt, and we took it to a big trailer repair place. And I actually took the axles to them brand new, and they were like, these are bent. And it had to be the owner. He goes, no, these are torsion. They're made that way because they're not used to that.
You know,
even the guys that were putting them on, they're like, I think there's something wrong with your axles.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think for a lot of people, that it's important to know that you can actually get the crown, so to speak, put back in the axles. You can go to an axle shop and you can get your axles corrected. So if you have an issue with your axles not being aligned, and that's creating a wear on your tires, because that's what happens when the axle is supposed to be like this and it's like this. Now the insides of your tires are going to wear.
Right.
That could also wear because of bearings. Bearings not being aligned or something else like this, that if the dealer says, no, we're not going to cover it, it's actually not as expensive as a repair as it sounds. Pulling off the axle and getting it reshaped at a axle shop is quite possible or doable.
Yeah. Now, I haven't done that. I wonder what the time frame is. I'm sure less than a day to have that done.
I guess I bring it up just to let people know that there is an option. I think sometimes – I think it's easy to be fixated on the warranty, and I think that's fine. If there's something that the manufacturer should correct, that's great. It might be a good idea to go find an independent third-party shop and get the quote to realize how much money are you really saving by not having your RV for potentially 3 months, so you can make that decision.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, especially if it's going to be in the middle of your vacation time, you know, when you're planning on doing this, well, now I have to wait and fight warranty.
Yeah.
Or I just have this.
I've talked to a lot of people where out of the principle, the manufacturer should replace this. And, you know, me personally, I'm not too big into that. I'm like, you know what, I'm just going to fix it, and it's going to cost me $100 or $200, and maybe they should fix it, but is it really worth the month? And I'll tell you one last tip here about that. There's a lot of people that take their RV in the wintertime to get repaired, and they think, hey, take your time, because they think they're getting free storage. They have no idea that when they tell the dealer, take their time, that means 6 months and you're not going to have it in the spring. So I always tell people, if you are going to go to the dealer to get any warranty work done, be very clear. I'm dropping it off on the 12th. I'm going to need it as soon as possible. Be the person that calls all the time, because you want it back. And then just pay for your storage. Don't use the dealer for free storage, or an RV is going to get backed into it on a forklift, or you're not going to see it for 3 to 6 months.
If you're lucky, if you're lucky.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's sounded the doom and gloom. We haven't all dealer experiences aren't bad, but the point is just don't try to double dip. If you're there for the warranty work, get the warranty work and get it back.
And here's the thing. There's not enough dealerships out there to service all the RVs that are out there.
They're not.
And unlike the automobile industry, where we have service shops and dealerships,
that's true.
Very few service shops out there. So we're relying on those dealerships, and I can tell you, they're happy whenever they have, you know, a storage lot full of RVs, because to them, that's guaranteed money.
Yeah.
if they race through that, they may have a great month, but mm-hmm. now they've got a fear. Oh, we don't have any more rigs to work on. You know, where's that? They have that, they fight that. What if we talk to them all the time about that?
But
you know, they're not business owners themselves. They're just there to manage that. And they'd much rather have 20 rigs out there waiting to be worked on.
That's true.
They can work their books.
Well, we covered a lot here, and a number of checklists have come out of this, and I can't tell you how thrilled Trish and I are to have you on the E3 team and contributing the way you do and bringing your level of expertise and professionalism to everything.
Well, expertise, yes. Professionalism,
we'll see. We'll see. But no, it's been great, and so we're going to summarize this call into written materials and other courses, and we've really covered a lot, but mostly some of the resources we talked about in the checklist will be available within the resources of this webinar. Yes. And I'm just excited to chat with you again and maybe even do some videos together and repair some stuff and break. I'll break the stuff and you repair them.
Well, sounds like a plan.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for taking the time. So much of it too. I know everyone's going to dig it. So, until next time, any other thoughts before we wrap up?
No, I just say, keep RVing and just be patient.
Yeah.
Just be patient.
That's a good point. Take your time. You mentioned earlier on in the when we got talking that a lot of the things that happen are self-inflicted. And a lot of that is actually not the rig breaking. It's us breaking the rig. And I think a majority of that just comes from being in a hurry.
Yeah, absolutely. So take your time and just enjoy it. Know that it's going to break down. It's high maintenance, but is it, if we know how to repair it or if we know what's wrong, I think that the value is so much greater, and our RVing experience, just really increases, to a level that we really want. If we just know and just be patient and know, okay, that's something that's fixable, I can take care of that.
And I've often thought that the severity of RVing, meaning it's serious business, it's big equipment, and we do have to be paying attention. That is what part of that makes it fun. I mean, if it was just easy, it wouldn't be quite as fun. I mean, when you talk about boats and planes and RVs and things that are big, I mean, that's part of what it makes it attractive is that it is serious and that you do have to be focused. And that's why it's a memory. That's why you look back and say that you really accomplished something. I mean, just pulling a house to the Tetons and back is not, something you take for granted. So it feels like you've actually done something when you get home.
Right. You just go fly and get a hotel if you're going to do that.
Yeah. All right. Great to chat with you as always. And until next time, we'll see you. We'll see you soon.
Mark, I greatly appreciate the time here.
Head over to www.e3camping.com to join the fun. You've been listening to the RV Fireside Chat Podcast with E3 Camping Association with Mark and Tricia, the next generation in RVing memberships.